So I'm joined by Derek Luss today from Air Consulting to talk about the subject of toxic leadership. And so Derek, it'd be great if you could just introduce yourself and give us an idea of who you are and what you do, and then we can get into things.
Yeah, sounds good. So my name is Derek Luss. My background, so I have a PhD in something called IO psychology, which is essentially applying psychological principles to business. I am the head of executive assessment and development at Air Consulting, and I specialize in helping organizations select and develop leaders in the C-suite. And I've also done a lot of thought leadership in the space, particularly around overcoming bad leadership in organizations. So I have a book coming out early 2022, and it's around that exact topic. How do we help organizations select good leaders and avoid toxic leadership in business?
Fantastic. So I think, you know, it's such a fascinating subject for everyone. You know, we're all influenced by leadership all the time. Most people are striving to be better at it. and I think organizations would love to have a higher caliber of leader working for them.
It's interesting because leadership has both stayed the same and changed over time. First, in some ways, leadership hasn't changed over literally the last like 100,000 years, right? In the last 100,000 years, it hasn't changed that much. It has always been about influencing people to set aside their own selfish agenda for the benefit of the group and its members, right? So it was always the same old story in hunter-gatherer bands, like I said, 100,000 years ago, where leaders were really the central node in the social network that, and their function is really to inspire cooperation and like I said, influence people to act on behalf of the group, the leader's vision, the mission, and so forth. And then the other thing is leaders are and have always been the embodiment of culture. So the values and the moral rules that influence what people believe is true in the world and also what they do. And I think that many business leaders actually forget this point, that their primary function is getting people to cooperate toward a vision or a greater goal. And instead, they double down on their own ability to execute and get things done. And they're very typically, when we do assessments and development, we have leaders that are overly concerned with being smart about strategy or knowing the business or being technically competent. Or just working really hard, right? And these things matter, certainly. I would never say that they don't matter. They matter for decision-making and so forth, but those facets of leadership are only a small part of the equation. And the primary function is actually to get people to cooperate. And like I said, that has literally always been the case in human affairs, and it actually always will be the case. The other way I look at this is there's always been, and by the way, I'll mention how leadership is different and will be different going into the future in a second, but the other way it's the same is there will always be four dimensions of human performance, regardless of the year, regardless of the time and place. There are four dimensions of human performance. There are four dimensions of culture that have been found in psychology. There's four dimensions of leadership at a high level. And the first one is relationships, right? If you think about a collective or a group of people, there has to be harmonious relationships in the group. So how leaders facilitate harmonious relationships is via a relationship-oriented leadership style, right? And how they do that primarily is coming off as having integrity, right? So leaders need to have integrity. They need to be perceived as integrity. Followers, one of the main dynamics in human affairs is that followers are on the lookout for corruption. They're on the lookout for leaders that come across as corrupt and self-absorbed. Think about all of the revolutions throughout history, right? So coming across as having integrity, having an enabling and empowering leadership style that involves, you know, coaching and mentoring and showing people that you're operating in the best interest of the collective. So that's one of the first dimensions of human performance. If there's no integrity in the group, you will have a failed collective, right? There has to be integrity. There has to be psychological safety. There has to be team cohesion and engagement. This is all about altruism, concern for others, and sort of this like relationship oriented leadership style is how I think about it. The second one is performance oriented. So you need to be nice to people. You need to have engagement, but you also have to want to win. You absolutely have to want to win. You need a performance oriented style that supplements the altruism and kindness that I'm talking about. So this is about being more forceful and directive at times. It's about setting stretch goals. It's holding people accountable. It's projecting confidence. It's leading from the front. It's, you know, exhibiting sort of this competitive spirit and creating an achievement oriented culture. So there's a lot of evidence for this. There's a really good book that you all could check out called The Achieving Society, and it was written by David McLeland. And basically, he assessed societal achievement by analyzing cultures around the world. He even looked in textbooks and children's books and different elements of culture. And what he found was those cultures that had more of an achievement orientation outperformed other cultures around the world. And that sort of achievement score at the national level predicted various outcomes such as economic development, total production, economic activity, national income, leveraging modern technologies, and so forth. So again, this is more of a competitive spirit. So you need altruism, you need a competitive spirit. And then the last two are the juxtaposition that we often see people talk about in business of strategy versus sort of execution and operations. So strategy versus operations. On the strategy side, you have evolution and change, and you have innovation, you have wild creativity, you have a long-term orientation. You have, you know, it's kind of more the visionary side. All groups will be looking to the future. How do you innovate? The reason for this is because ecologies change, right? And they always have. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors were dealing with an extremely harsh environment. They had to innovate on the fly in, again, a harsh environment. Same thing in business. The world's changing. Think of the pandemic and how much organizations had to change like on a dime. And that's strategy. You have to have a collective that can evolve. And then the other side is execution. The challenge here is execution is all about structure. It's about prudence and conscientiousness. It's about operations. It's about Six Sigma, right? It's all like prudent operational structure. The division of labor, as was noted by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, it's the division of labor, its structure, its roles and responsibilities. And it's more stability versus change. So human groups always face that challenge of, you know, how do we change for the future versus, you know, not spin out of control and have some structure.
John, I have a question on that actually, which is, if I think about a lot of the executives and trees that I know, if that makes any sense, I tend to find that structure and being great at structure is almost perceived to be, you know, less desirable. Maybe it seems like the person at the top is always, you know, this great big, you know, we hear the word visionary, we hear the word creative thrown around. Yeah. But it's kind of interesting because without that structure, they can't be successful.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Organizations are, I think that's one of the main dynamics at a high level going on is exactly what you noted, which is we have to be visionary and innovative. We have to incrementally innovate. We have to have some people that are productive disruptors and are thinking completely different. But at the same time, we can spin out of control. Like you can actually change and innovate too much. And getting things done in an efficient manner is, and also leveraging current and past competitive advantages. So the future is about change and new competitive advantages and new business models. But we also have something going on today that we have to execute on in an efficient way so we can do things like increase profit margins and just have enough efficiency to get things done. And that more stability side is, you know, some of the structure that keeps us from spinning out of control. And I think you see this in different industries where, you know, in some industries they'll emphasize kind of tradition, safety, and structure. And then some other industries, it's like all innovation. And I think that's by design, but at the same time, those that have a healthy balance will outperform those that don't.
Yeah, fascinating. I feel like I also interrupted your train of thought, so.
Oh, no worries. I was just saying that leadership is really been the same for a long time. It'll continue to be the same in a lot of ways. I would also say it's changed though, and it will continue to change in some ways. The first way is in the past, if you think about leadership, it was about, if you think in the real distant past, it was about, you know, brawn and hunting ability and how big you are and how aggressive you were. And that was actually the case in human history 2.5 million years ago, even 20,000 years ago. And that is, interestingly, that's sort of the old cognitive archetype or architecture that we're using today to select leaders, which is kind of interesting. Hence why most leaders tend to be interpersonally aggressive and tall. You're actually more likely to be selected into leadership positions if you're tall, and it's based on old human psychology. So that was kind of the more aggressiveness, I guess, brawn, you know, just being big in stature, really. Then it became about the brain. So this is thinking. If you think of the Enlightenment in Europe in the late 18th century, you know, and the advent of philosophy and knowledge work, humans started to focus on sort of thinking and intellect. And I think in the future, it's going to be about empathy. And I think this is because the world will become increasingly global. You know, this is something that's been said for a long time, but it's actually true. And the pace is increasing. I mean, again, to reference the pandemic, I mean, how fast did we have to change on a dime in business is just wild because everything is so interconnected in the world. The world will be characterized by fast information transfer, multicultural teams. One of the big ones is merging ideologies around the world. You used to have silos of ideologies, and now everything is sort of becoming merged together. And what empathy allows someone to do is see things from another person's perspective and adjust their behavior dexterously based on the situation, right? So think about globalization. Today, we're living in a world that is beautifully diverse. We are no longer, like I said, isolated from other cultures. When you're leading in organizations that are global today, you're likely to have a multicultural team. And this idea is actually called implicit leadership theory, where your followers, based on their background, their cultural background, actually expect different things from you as a leader, right? Like the followers are looking to you as the leader and they expect you to do certain things. And it's sort of based on their ideology, their thoughts about leadership. So the best global leaders are actually able to have that empathy and know where their direct reports and their peers and so forth, where their colleagues are coming from. And they're able to kind of shift and bend and flex their style based on the situation. I think that points to the idea of learning agility being one of the most important single skills that an individual can have. If you think about all the things that we've talked about in terms of change and, you know, trying to lead in different cultures, just being able to learn quickly and change. I mean, job roles are changing, everything's changing quickly. So the idea of being able to take in new information and being open to new information, open to new experiences is very, very important. And then I would also say, you know, in terms of learning other cultures, there's an experiential component where, you know, the best way to learn is to have your boots on the ground and be there, of course. But there are other ways that you can learn about different cultures. One way is actually intellectually. So you can read about other cultures. There's a ton written about leading in cultures around the world. So you could have sort of a base understanding of what followers are going to expect based on their cultural background. With that said, you won't want to jump to conclusions and sort of stereotype people in that way, because there's massive individual differences even within cultures of what people expect. So you have to be very careful of that. And I think that points to the importance of empathy and really being able to have those crucial conversations with your team about what they expect from leaders, how things are going, and you can kind of get an idea of what they expect from leadership. And then the last point I would make is there's actually assessments for this. So what leaders really find useful is being able to assess the values of their teams and being able to see, hey, this is what the team as a whole values. This is individual beliefs on the team. This is what they expect from leadership. This is how they want things to go. These are the different personalities and so forth. That way you kind of have a localized idea of what you're working with in terms of personalities and values.
Yeah, I guess it also begs the question, like, when do you check in and how often do you check in with your team to make sure that you're staying up to date? Because obviously over a period of years, that ideology may change, based on society and what's going on in the world. Pandemic being a pretty good example.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the things that leaders, fail to do is a strong word, but I would say could do more of is actually that exact thing of checking in with their teams. What we find, and so we do a lot of leadership assessments. Of course, we do a lot of 360 assessment where the leader gets feedback from their, their direct team, their peers, their supervisor, and so forth. And one of the things we see often is that leaders aren't having career conversations with their direct reports. They're not checking in when it's not about performance goals, right? And if you think about those two, I mentioned four dimensions of human performance. One is the balance between sort of relationships and performance. And what leaders tend to double click on is the performance side, which I think is super important. But at the same time, how can you check in just on how people are doing? What are their career aspirations? How are things going for them? What is their feedback look like for you and the rest of the team? Because I think this, and last point on this, this is why humility is actually so important in leadership. Empathy and humility are key because, to your point, you need to canvas all of the information, right? You need to know what are in the brains of other people, and you need to be open to that so you know how to kind of adjust your style to them and what the team needs at the time. When I think about destructive leadership or, toxic leadership, bad leadership in organizations, there's two ways to look at it. One way to think about bad leadership is just extreme leadership styles. So interestingly, everyone has their own psychological makeup that's, based on genetics and, their socialization, their childhood experiences and so forth, right? So everyone has a certain leadership style. The best leaders are the ones that are able to be versatile and recognize the other side, as I noted with those four dimensions, being able to do performance and relationships, being able to do strategy and operations. So what I think of when I think of bad leadership is extreme psychological and behavioral profiles where an individual, over-rotates on the relationship side of leadership or over-rotates on the performance side of leadership, or, they're over-rotating on strategy and they're so innovative and creative, but it turns into eccentricity. They're very eccentric and their ideas are way out in the left field and actually can't be implemented on, right? Or they're a very technical operational executive and they're so structured that they're over-rotating on that style and they're not considering the future. You have the relationship oriented executives that have a tough time delivering challenging feedback, and then you have the performance oriented executives that are pushing, but they're demoralizing and disengaging their teams. So I think the first thing I think of is that, which is extreme behaviors versus being able to cover those four aspects of leadership effectiveness. And then the other thing I think of is personality dimension. So there's been a lot of research on why might these sort of extreme behaviors manifest. And there's been a lot of research just on, you know, what is narcissism, psychopathy, Machiavellianism, and so forth in the C-suite. What does that look like? And what that really comes down to is people have certain stress reactions that, you know, they might be in general 90, 95% of the time doing well in terms of leadership, but they have these certain, as opposed to behaviors, they have these certain personality characteristics that come out, you know, oftentimes when under stress and pressure. So, you know, they might, we kind of break them down into three different buckets where a leader might be ineffective because they're moving away from people when under stress and pressure. So that's like absconding from the team when things get tough. It's not having conversations, right? It's the leadership style that's like, hey, just do it. Just get it done. There's no crying in business. Get it done, right? And that ends the social interaction. It's over. Go do it. So we have that sort of stress reaction. It's kind of the just get it done, or the leader will become introverted. Then we have the one that's more common, which is under stress and pressure, where an executive will get more socially dominant. And this helps leaders to ascend to leadership positions because it's interpersonally more aggressive, but it can be deleterious to their performance if it ends up turning into some of those things that I mentioned around overconfidence and kind of manipulation and things like that, that we actually often see more prevalent in the C-suite. We don't see much from a business size perspective, but we do see it different based on level of leadership. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. The first reason is that these personality characteristics actually help someone emerge as the leader. Right. So we think there's a difference between leadership emergence and leadership effectiveness. So getting to the top of a large bureaucratic organization requires a certain skill set, right? Leadership emergence has one skill set. Leadership effectiveness has another skill set. So these individuals are really good at the politics side and managing up and sort of navigating a hierarchy. You could think of House of Cards as an extreme example, right? Where you have kind of the social manipulation, overconfidence and things like that actually help people to get ahead in the workplace. The challenge is those same characteristics lead to ineffective leadership. So I think that's one of the basic challenges, or the fundamental challenge in organizational affairs, is that exact point that you're going to have people that are hard charging, socially skilled, charismatic, that get to the top and emerge as a leader, but they might not be good at actual leadership. So that's the first thing. The second thing is power corrupts. So in psychology, there's a million studies done on this. There's a guy, Adam Galinsky, that has done just a bunch of studies on this point, which is the idea that power tends to corrupt and get in the way of empathy. Okay, mm-hmm. So imagine you have these individuals with certain personality characteristics and dispositions, they navigate to the top and power corrupts, right? So that's two mechanisms that are going kind of hand in hand to create a lack of empathy in the C-suite. And I think that's one of the challenges that organizations have, is how can we spot individuals that are charismatic and they can be the center of attention and they can lead from the front and be confident, all of these important points, but they also have the other side of leadership effectiveness where, you know, some of those dispositions don't go too far.
Yeah. It almost sounds like they've started to believe their own press, developed an ego, and then the power has kind of led to them, you know, shutting down the need for other people's opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an old quote by Lord Acton, and it's power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's that's essentially what you see in organizations. The first thing I would say is bad leadership is the norm. You know, if you survey organizations, 65 to 70% of people will say that the worst aspect of their job is their tyrannical supervisor, right? And the reason we know that is because we've done these surveys. We've done a million surveys. If you survey organizations right now, the employees will say that the worst aspect of their job is their immediate boss. And the rate is, you know, 60, 65, 70%, regardless of the organization. So bad management is the number one cause of disengagement. And, you know, all you need to do to show this point, again, not only organizational surveys, but if you go to Google right now and type in my boss is, and see what it auto corrects, like see what people are Googling about leadership. Yeah. And it's actually pretty disturbing. Human intuition is not working, and it has not worked through the history of humanity. So interviewing someone and talking to someone to select them into a senior leadership role, it just doesn't work. And you can see this even from a DEI angle, where left to our own devices, we will select leaders that are like us and that really are charismatic and that we like versus their true ability to lead. So the first thing is we have to have some humility that we might get it wrong about people without some sort of objective data. So I think the first value that the organization must have is making people decisions based on people analytics, based on objective assessments of leadership capabilities versus an unstructured interview, which is essentially a coin toss. What you're evaluating in an unstructured interview is an individual's social skill. And there might be some utility to that if it's a sales role. You know, maybe it is important to see how they interact with people and so forth. But you are fundamentally, you're not evaluating their leadership capabilities via an interview, especially when it's unstructured. The second thing is, I think organizations need to define leadership in terms of team performance, not the success of individual careers. So the purpose of leadership isn't to get promoted, right? So I don't really care how fast someone has gotten promoted. You know, that's one idea or mechanism that organizations use, is they say, hey, this person, you know, Jane, Sam, Pat, whoever, they've gotten promoted 15 times, you know, since they started here. And I don't really care if they've gotten promoted. What that tells me is that they're working hard and they're probably socially skilled and good at politics. It doesn't really tell me if they're good at leadership. So what we need to do is ask their direct reports how they're doing and how they're leading. Because if you think about leadership, who is the consumer of leadership? Direct reports are the ones being led. You might have a leader that's managing up or managing out to peers and so forth, but direct reports are the ones being led. And that sounds obvious, but it's actually not how leaders are promoted and selected in organizations today.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I read something recently. People were talking about references and somebody brought up the question, why doesn't a hiring manager give you their references for people that they've previously led? So that as the employee coming in, you could get a read on them. I have a question on which I think this stumbles, which is, I feel like all references are biased, because if you're asking somebody to give you examples, they're going to give you the best examples. So I guess there's also that question, which is there a mechanism which could be deployed to get around that?
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. I mean, if you think of references, especially if you ask the individual to provide references, it's like, it's a pretty low bar to have three people that'll say something good about you, right?
Yeah.
So virtually everyone should be able to do that. If it is easier if it's internal to the organization, because you can do 360 surveys and 360 assessment where you're asking 15 people what they think about this individual's leadership style. And what we often do is have someone else kind of double check their lists, right? So if we have a leader in an organization, we're asking them, hey, provide us with 12 people that can comment on your leadership style and so forth. And then we might have an HRBP or maybe an HR business partner, maybe their supervisor, someone will double check their list to make sure it's a good mix of individuals that they work with. And I think that's the best way to do it when it's internal. When it's external, when an organization is hiring someone from outside, it's a little bit more difficult to do something like a 360 assessment. So I think there, the best way to go about it is objective assessments that get at leadership potential, not from other people's perspective, but from, you know, personality, maybe critical thinking tests and things like that can be very, very predictive of human performance, especially if used right. So what we do is we actually build personality-based algorithms that are able to predict someone's leadership style and culture fit. And that really supplements sort of the background and experience portion of the assessment.
And that's actually what I was going to ask next, which is, do you think there's a bias where people say, well, you know, this person has 20 years experience, therefore they must be better than the person who has 7 years experience or 8 years experience? And I'd love to know if you've lent into that to try to generate data around it.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite questions, because this is one of the major problems in selecting leaders today, because this has been well studied in psychology and leadership research, which is interesting, but I don't know if it's that organizations don't know about the research or what, but this has been studied for 20 years. And experience actually doesn't matter that much in executive leadership roles. Now, that's not to say zero experience is acceptable, but what I am saying is if the person has around 5 years is the sweet spot. And if you think about it, why would that be the case? Well, first of all, most people in the executive ranks objectively have above average IQ. So if you run the IQ of senior executives in the C-suite executives, the IQ is very high. It doesn't take them 5 years to learn business or learn the job. The other thing is, if you think about what an executive does, a lot of it is learning by doing, but a lot of it is conceptual as well. So you can actually learn a lot about a business by looking at documents, looking at the org chart, reading, you know, what has the previous strategy been? There's a lot of ways to learn the business that aren't learning by doing. Some jobs, that's not the case. It's completely learning by doing. But in executive roles, again, a lot of it is learning by doing, but they only need around 5 years. In addition to that, once you get to 15 years and 20 years, there's actually a negative correlation between experience and effectiveness in the role. That's not to say don't hire anyone, right, with 20 years experience. What I'm saying is that there is a correlation between having 20 years of experience and not performing as well as someone that has 5 or 6 years. Again, why might that be the case? Well, they come into the role with certain rigidities around how they've done things over the last 20 years versus someone that is 5 or 6 years in. And then the last point I'll make on this topic, because I'm really, really passionate about it, is that this has pretty dramatic consequences for DEI. Because historical oppression or historical, the lack of opportunities historically will continue on, right? Because the people that have 25 years of experience have been in the status quo for a long time versus, you know, others that may have had to take a break, you know, for some reason or weren't given opportunities 20 years ago, et cetera. So, that ideology of needing 20 years of experience actually reinforces the status quo versus helps us change for the better.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating because it would appear that if you had 15, 20 years experience, we almost need the leader that appreciates that their style has to adapt and that they don't know it all, which again harks back to this idea of empathy. And yet if we rewound the clock 20 years, empathy was in short supply, I think, in the C-suites and things like that which surround us. Yeah, I think this is absolutely fascinating. I guess the final question which I would ask is also just about soft skills over hard skills. I think we've touched on it already, which is the ability to facilitate the group is arguably more important than, you know, a technical skill. I guess the question would be, is there a point in a career ladder where that switches from one side to the other side, and whether or not that's definable?
Yeah, you know, I would say that in some industries, I would say it's about 80%. I mean, if you were to break it down to numbers, most of leadership is the social side. It's organizations are really a collective of people trying to get something done. And leadership, especially as you ascend in the hierarchy and get to executive roles and C-suite roles, if you look at what these individuals do on a day-to-day basis, it's all social. It's meetings, you know, it's meetings, it's strategy, it's making decisions, it's collaborating, it's leading people. Now there are certain business units where there's going to have to be a little bit more on the technical side. And I think this matters most for perceptions of competence. Because if you think of why someone follows a leader, there's integrity, there's charisma, there's vision, but one is competence. So, you know, I've been sort of comparing or juxtaposing the past with the present. And if you think of the past, you know, the best hunter had some power in the group, right? The best hunter gets power because they have a certain technical ability. And it's the same today where, you know, the most competent, the ones that seem the smartest, you know, might make the best decisions, do get a leg up on other people in terms of sort of establishing leadership in the group. So I think it's mainly important for that. And then there is some kind of baseline level of, you know, business knowledge and certain experiences that you would need. And again, I think you can get those via knowledge and MBA reading, you know, certain experiences, you know, and I think it's, again, I think though leadership is about 80% or 90% social. It's really about influencing a group toward a common goal, keeping engagement levels high, keeping team morale high. And that's sort of the social side. And then there's the technical competence. And then there's this, the decision-making side, which is, you know, very important, kind of the strategy and operations point, you know, that I made.
Yeah, fantastic. Derek, I think this is such a fascinating subject. I feel like we could talk for about another 3 hours on it. but I think this is a wonderful, wonderful intro to this and also to you. I think what I would ask of anybody else out there is that, you know, if they have further questions, maybe to reach out to you, connect with you, and, you know, continue those conversations in another forum. We would love to have you back, maybe to kind of do a secondary deep dive on this. But from my side, you know, thank you so much for taking the time. Certainly, I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I leave a wiser man than I started. And I'm sure a lot of other people do as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. And yeah, I would love to talk again soon.
Great. Thanks very much.